gentlemen, I sympathize with you. This thing in our heads, it comes and goes, many times with little that we can do about it. Most people call it PTSD. I prefer the term PTS. I don't think we have a disorder. Or I go with the term post-combat normal, which is what I named the show after. I think that anyone who has seen the darkness of combat cannot return without some mental and moral questions. And it's hard to understand your feelings. It's really hard to understand your feelings. I can explain why in great detail as it relates to physiology and memory storage. The traumatic memories are stored in a different part of the brain than the regular memories. But the truth is simple. PTS is a condition of feeling. It's what combat makes you feel, not a memory of what happened as much as a condition of your emotional reactions to it. The memories are hard to suppress because they've linked themselves with certain sights, certain sounds, certain smells that live in your subconscious. The only way to fix it is to bring those memories out. And I'm going to say this in a safe and controlled environment. And to restore them to your conscious memory with more pleasant things associated with them. And we'll get into that in great detail later. PTSD is a complex subject that I'll have to explain better on the podcast, and the doctors will explain on the podcast. But the point remains, it must, like any other wound, be opened, examined, and cleaned. Imagine that it's an infection in your soul. You must face it. I know it sucks, but it truly is the only option. Anything else is just symptom suppression. I get to the point on this subject that I begin to ramble, and I do not want to lose you. I do not want to lose the main focus of my main point. And the main reason that you've deep issues is that you're a caring person. Your main issues can certainly be linked to others' welfare, not your own. Can be linked to things you did, things you saw others do. Your deepest problems with combat come because of the loss of others, both life, great injury. There's a million reasons why. I know veterans well enough to know that this is true. You feel responsible for certain things that happened that were out of your control, even though you know in your conscious mind, or you have a hard time letting it go because it's stored in a spot that your conscious mind cannot access. So that is why we have to bring them out. Now, we'll try to pass on information that we think will help, but the truth is simple. You need to go through this for yourself when you can. You need to go through this therapy for yourself when you can, a group therapy setting. I also understand wanting to go back, as sick as that sounds to those who've never been, to the wives, to the mothers who are listening, to the people who just don't understand. I would leave tonight, given the option. I would leave tonight. If a van pulled up right now and let me, I would leave tonight to go back. The combat zone is the only place that a warrior feels complete, because that's the only place that we can make sense of our training, the only place we can make sense of our hypervigilance. Combat is the last place that I felt like I had a true brotherhood with others. No person in this world who has never been to combat can understand this. They can never understand me. They can never be a friend in the way that our overseas brothers were. They just can't. It leads to feelings of loneliness, even though you might be surrounded by people who love you. You're still lonely because you don't have your combat brothers. Again, I tell you, this is why you go to group, because you will find new brothers who have been through what you've been through. And they might be from a different war. They might be from a different time. They might be a different generation. But they're your brothers. I guarantee it. As soon as you get in there, you're going to meet brothers. You feel as if you're alone because those in the real world are not the same as you. They're not the same as those guys that you sat in an OP with for days watching some MSR somewhere doing IED interdiction. They're not the same as the guys that you were with on your COP, on your FOB, on your base. They're just not the same. And that is the one main reason that I want to go back, is the loneliness. Because I don't have my brothers around. And you know what makes me feel better is having my brothers. When I get to go to a Marine Corps ball, when I get to have one of my friends come over and we have a beer and we talk about how cool we used to be. And we talk about the things that no one else can talk to me about because they understand. I'll stop this now because I get long-winded. But know that I do care about you. And I would love to discuss this further with any one of you. You can find us at Post Combat Normal on Facebook. Feel free to message us. I'll answer anything I can, anything I have the ability to, and anything I don't have the ability to. I'll get you to the doctors. I'll get you to somebody who can help you locally. Wherever you are in the world, wherever you are in the country, wherever you are in my state, wherever you are in this planet, know that we care, know that I care, know that all my brothers care, and there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of us who will do anything we can to help you out. So again, I love you all my brothers. Semper Fi, Sergeant Morgan. Hello and welcome to the next episode here of Post Combat Normal. I want to go ahead and kick this off by introducing to my right is Dr. Rob Schneider.
Hello.
And I just wanted to thank him one more time for coming in. Today, Dr. Schneider, what are we going over today?
Today the topic will be numbing and avoidance, which I thought would be appropriate given that it's kind of the outer shell of defenses that keeps all the other mechanisms of post-traumatic stress kind of hidden. It's a numbing and avoidance are the default positions that combat vets go into after their service, and unless confronted, all the things that are really keeping the machinery of post-traumatic stress as a syndrome moving forward, all those things remain kind of hidden and inaccessible. Excuse me.
It's easy to hide behind that stuff. It really is.
I think it is, and I think it's particularly easy because so often vets don't even know they're doing it. It's such a natural, instinctual, and automatic reaction to the kinds of stresses you guys have been under that you just go into that mode naturally. It's an extension of what you had to do as an adaptation in the war zone and carries forward automatically into the civilian world afterward. So I wanted to, if I could, just outline where I'm going to go today. I want to talk about what, why, costs and solutions. So what numbing and avoidance really are, dissect them a little bit. I want to talk about why they occur so pervasively, universally. What are the real long-term costs of remaining in that position? And what are the solutions that we have found will help a person make inroads against the avoidance once one has made the decision to do so? So with that in mind, I just want to briefly sketch where numbing and avoidance fit in the overall syndrome of post-traumatic stress. Avoidance is actually one of the formal clusters of symptoms. The first one that is kind of the hallmark of post-traumatic stress, we talked about last week or last time, that's the re-experiencing or intrusions cluster, which includes intrusive thoughts and images, flashbacks, nightmares, and triggers. Reactivity to environmental triggers. So those are the symptoms that really distinguish post-traumatic stress from all the other syndromes that we diagnose in my field, because the re-experiencing cluster represents the trauma memory itself coming back on the trauma survivor. Then we have the probably the most universally known, the more obvious symptom cluster, which is hyperarousal. That's the famous anger that combat veterans exhibit. Anxiety, panic attacks, hypervigilance, which means being on guard all the time, watching for danger. As we talked about last time, trauma changes the brain such that a person becomes basically a danger detection machine that is honed to a tremendous sensitivity. And then along with that, sleep disturbance, sleeping with one eye open, very few hours a night, jumping at loud noises, and with all that stress banging around in the brain, difficulty concentrating is another hyperarousal symptom. So that brings us to the avoidance cluster, today's topic. In 2013, that cluster was formally broken up into two subparts, one being conscious avoidance of triggers, trauma memories, situations that remind one of the trauma in some fashion. And then what I think is called, I can't remember the exact wording, something like negative alterations in mood and cognition, which means the person's emotional functioning and thinking are changed fairly drastically by traumatic experiences in a negative way. So pessimism, cynicism, depression, guilt, mistrust of other people, all of those things represent sort of a negative skew in the way a person thinks and the way the person feels. And then along with that, we get social detachment, loss of interest in things that were normally enjoyed, and what I regard as the most important symptom in that whole cluster, which is emotional numbing. So again, I'm going to keep this distinction in mind throughout today's podcast, the main distinction here being external avoidance and internal avoidance. The external avoidance is what we think of when we talk about environmental triggers and situations, principally social interactions that combat veterans are aware of steering clear of. These are conscious and chosen avoidance maneuvers. And as I mentioned last time, you know, think of this as part of a dynamic system. Trauma memories ambush a person. Extreme emotional reactions, principally rage, can be evoked in the blink of an eye by anything that reminds the person of the trauma. And that's not just sights and sounds and smells. That can be any situation that brings forth one of the main psychological conditions of trauma, which is helplessness. If a person feels in a situation in which they rapidly sense they are not in command of the outcome, they will have a tremendous fear and or anger reaction. So dealing with a bureaucracy like the VA, which has gotten, you know, a bad rap, in part for good reasons, but also just because it is a gigantic bureaucracy with many moving parts, and veterans have to deal with waiting times and uncertainty, meeting new doctors, having it suggested to them that they try a medication whose side effects they don't, can't predict and are very uncomfortable with. So any situation where a vet feels like their control is slipping away will create a great deal of extreme stress. And this is particularly true when we're talking about interactions with other people. So being asked, say, by a spouse to go to a family gathering where Uncle So-and-so, the last time you saw me, asked you a stupid question about war. Often vets are terrified, not just really so much of what's going to be done to them, but how they may react to other people if they're provoked intentionally or inadvertently. So just the anticipation of some kind of negative social interaction or confrontation will cause vets to, quote-unquote, bunker in and very much steer clear of anything that might hold that possibility. So these are all external avoidance decisions. And again, in the dynamic syndrome of post-traumatic stress, we have to understand that we have a person who's being ambushed by memories, triggered unpredictably, and always on high alert at a baseline. So trying to dial down the potential for extreme triggering is a totally understandable reaction to that. And what you get then are very pervasive patterns of avoidance of situations that might cause that triggering. And those are mainly interactions with other people. So that's a major issue, and there are some systematic ways that a person can confront that. I'll come back to that in a little bit, ways of confronting that external avoidance that are a necessary part of the healing process. In my mind, though, even more important is dealing with the internal avoidance, and that is steering clear, sometimes consciously but often unconsciously, of one's own feelings, one's own traumatic memories. These automatic and habitual ways of dealing with uncomfortable recollections or emotions are learned in the traumatic situation or the traumatic conditions themselves. It's simply not possible to let oneself be flooded with emotion in a life and death situation and function at the necessary level for survival. So some way of muting those internal reactions to traumatic stress have to be developed very quickly, or a person's ability to function is compromised, and therefore the safety of everybody all around that person is also compromised. So to some degree, this is trained into a person in a sort of priming or preparatory way during the intensity of basic training and advanced training, but often what really brings it is exposure to traumatic stress itself. And as we talked about last week, there are some automatic changes in the brain that make a person more likely to react in survival-promoting ways, i.e. fight or flight. So ramping up the ability to respond while simultaneously stifling emotions such as grief, such as terror, such as overwhelming sorrow, all those things have to be immediate or the person is in deep trouble. Okay, so why don't we take it then with that distinction in mind of external and internal avoidance, why don't we talk a little bit about specifics? I'd like to get your help, Joe, if you'd be willing to share a little bit. When I teach the class, what I do at this point is ask veterans to tell me, what do you personally avoid routinely? What are some situations and or experiences that you're aware of avoiding almost all the time. And I thought we could talk a little bit about that, and then I was going to read the consensus from the literature on what are the 8 or 10 most commonly, to the point of almost universally, avoided situations for vets with post-traumatic stress. But how about you, Joe? Can you tell us a little bit about your own patterns?
I'm certain on the list my favorite one is I wouldn't go in a crowd if you paid me. I hate crowds. It takes a lot. It takes a lot for me to go into them. It takes me – I mean, there's some times where you just can't avoid it. There's just times where you absolutely have to, for whatever reason, whether it's a kid's soccer game, you know, your kid has to do something, and you have to be there. I mean, if you're going to be a good dad, you have to do certain things.
Sure.
So you go, but it takes a day to shake it off afterwards. And I mean, I can definitely give you a lot of the symptoms that I had before and how they're reacting now, but
sure.
Because at this point in the class, I was a lot worse than I am now, obviously. I mean, that was 3 years ago, so.
Yeah.
But either way, I mean, I still sit in a certain place in a restaurant if I go to a restaurant. I still act a certain way when I'm around people. You avoid family functions if you think that you're going to be – not for your own sake, I guess, but for their sake, because I'm afraid of the reaction I give to a question might make me unwelcome at every Thanksgiving instead of just this one. So if I miss this one, maybe my next year I'll be able to shake it off, and I won't tell grandma to pass the fucking peas, you know, or I won't yell at somebody for asking me a question that I think is inappropriate, or I won't, you know, knock my uncle out for saying something anti whatever political view he has, you know. And you realize, man, if I do that, I'm never going to be welcome back. And it's bad for my family, but it's way worse when it's a wife, a girlfriend, one of their family. I mean, if you go to you know, if you go to their house and you knock out their uncle, not only will I lose this family function, but I might lose my wife. And so you just don't go. And I can't tell you how many times people have asked me to go to events, and sometimes they're even veteran events. Hey, let's go and we're going to give toys – or not toys. We're going to give money to the Wounded Warriors Project, and we're going to drive down to San Diego and do that. And the odds of me driving all the way to San Diego and back are about zero. It's about zero. There's no chance that I'm going to drive 8 hours without there being an issue. There's no chance that I'm going to drive down a road. I drive when I'm absolutely forced to. Yeah, other than that, my wife drives everywhere. There's no chance that I'm going to be in the driver's seat unless it's a necessary thing. It has to need to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm trying to think of other things, but I think your list will be more all-inclusive than mine.
Well, actually,
and I'm probably going to agree with you as you – as you say, I'm going to go, yep, I didn't do that. I still don't do that because, you know, you forget a lot of the stuff because it becomes so normal to you. You forget that it's a symptom.
Yeah.
Because it's absolutely just how I live.
Right.
It's not a – to me, it's no longer a symptom. It just is life. This is what life is, and you live with it. And, you know, if you had your arm cut off when you were two, you don't have an arm. Get over it. Like, you live without it. And in this case, I had my brain shaken, so I don't – do certain things, and it just is how it is.
Yeah, so. That's absolutely well said, Joe. And I think the things you said either encompassed or touched on a lot of the things on the list here. So absolutely, avoidance of crowds, I would say, is just about as close to a universal way of being as I've run across with the veterans I work with. And it raises the question of what really is the cost of certain avoidance maneuvers. Not all avoidance is bad. Not all avoidance is costly. For instance, probably the single most universally avoided situation among veterans I've worked with is 4th of July fireworks.
Yeah.
For a variety of pretty obvious reasons, not just the explosions, but I've been told many times that the sound of the fireworks coming out of the tube sounds a lot like a mortar, exiting a mortar tube. So that combined with jostling crowds, long lines at concession stands, people behind you, people all around you, not being able to get your back against something, 4th of July is a no-go for a lot of folks. And is that really a problem? For some it might be, for others it's not. I know plenty of veterans who have avoided the 4th of July for half a century, and they're just fine at home, and that's cool. When it becomes so pervasive, though, that you never show up, say, at a family function, wives have to constantly explain your absence, or there's just sort of an embarrassed silence about it, if it starts to take a toll on one's closest relationships, then you start to really have to make a pragmatic analysis of whether it's worth confronting. So here's the list. These are the things that are most universally expressed by veterans in terms of avoidance. Standing or sitting physically close to another person that one does not know, particularly having someone behind you. So grocery lines would be a classic example. Movie theaters, sporting events. I think you mentioned you're having attended some Kings games recently.
Yeah, I've been trying real hard. It takes a lot, though. I got to admit, even with 3 years of therapy, taking pills, it still is a physical and mental drain to go. But I want my kids to be able to do things. Dr. Schneider knows me really well, so he knows that I call it headbutting it till it dies. I'm going to do it even if it hurts me, even if it makes me unhappy, because I want my family to be happy more than I want myself to be happy. But it sucks. There's days where you go to the game and you don't have any fun. There's days where you do things and it's not fun, but I figure if I do it enough times, eventually I'll get through it. And maybe that's not an accurate assessment, but that's the Marine in me that says, again, headbutt it till it dies. If it sucks and it's not fun and it scares you, then that's exactly what you should be doing that day, because that's what will push you through it. Now, not everybody's ready for that stage. Don't get me wrong. I don't want you to try that on day one before therapy, where you're going to go into a month-long hole in a dark room and you don't want to talk to anybody. That's something that I'm doing, again, after 3 years of therapy, after, you know, countless personal sessions, after lots of pills, after, you know, a long, long, long soul-searching process. So don't think that I mean day one, minute one, just go out to a New York Knicks game or something and you're just going to be fine, because you won't be. You'll come home and you'll want to hide in a dark room. And hey, again, after all that stuff, I still do that sometimes. I still come home and I feel like I was surrounded. I have very specific seats. There's cement to two sides of me. There is no one in front of me. I'm very, very particular about things. So again, don't think that when he says I go to a game that it's a simple event. There's a thousand things that go into it. And it's, yeah, it's not nearly as simple. I guess I can say it this way. If I was a non-combat PTSD veteran, or again, non-combat, post-combat normal person, you just buy tickets and you go to the game. You just go, which is baffling to me that people can even consider going in a crowd of 18,000 people that they don't know, unarmed, as if it's normal. It's baffling. But again, I'll transfer the mic back over to him, because I could go for hours on this, because it blows my mind what other people do and that they don't feel fear when they do it. I don't know if I'm a sheepdog and I've just gotten used to the evil in the world, or if they're sheep and they just haven't, or if I'm just that crazy that I think that they're sheep. But whatever it is, I cannot imagine being one of them where I could just take any two tickets and go sit there.
Joe, I'm glad you mentioned that, because for those who are listening to this podcast who don't have post-traumatic stress but who are interested in the struggles and the improvement, the growth of someone who does have the burden of the condition, I think it's really important to have the humility to recognize that we who don't have this boulder hanging around our necks are able to enjoy things with an unquestioning freedom that these folks often simply can't even contemplate, much less jump in and do unthinkingly. So it's important for us to respectfully recognize the immensity of the struggle, just to do things that we wouldn't consider just everyday sorts of events. It's really amazing to me, even as someone who works with post-traumatic stress every day, sometimes I think I lose touch for a minute with just the enormousness of the effort that it takes sometimes to go out and engage in the world after the world's taught you that it's really too dangerous a place to be involved with. So it's not just huge crowds of people. Another very difficult situation for combat stress sufferers is talking to strangers, especially in an intimate environment where you're being asked to share your thoughts, your feelings beyond a superficial level. The classic example of this, and it's incredibly difficult, is talking to a therapist for the first time, coming in for an intake appointment, coming in for an assessment, sitting down with a doctor in an office and being asked probing questions about your trauma, about your deepest fears, your relationship problems, your self-esteem, all these profoundly intrusive and invasive questions often are asked routinely as part of the intake process. And again, as a therapist, I have to remind myself that, you know, this is routine stuff for me in a way, and this is torment for the person I'm sitting with. So talking to strangers, and it's particularly difficult when it's a psychiatrist, because those appointments are briefer and the vet has been referred there for potential medication, and maybe somebody you don't even know is suddenly asking you again to talk about your deepest, darkest symptoms and wanting to provide you with a chemical to control them. So many guys tell me, you know, I went in there, I played the game. I basically said, I'm okay, doc, don't worry about it. Same thing sometimes with the claims process when you go in for a compensation and pension exam. Too many vets minimize. They don't want to reveal what they're really struggling with because, hell, they don't know this person. So talking to strangers and sudden abrupt demands for emotional intimacy can be extremely difficult.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted to say this. People who – again, you were mentioning people who are listening who don't have PTSD. To understand that, imagine having to stand naked in front of a stranger.
Yeah.
But that's the emotional feeling that you get when a person you don't know – when you go in for, say, a compensation appointment, you meet a doctor, and 2 minutes later they ask you about your deepest, darkest, most horrifying moment you've ever experienced in your life. And then can you compound on that? Can you tell me about that? No. In fact, I can't. And I'm even right now I'm getting chills up my back and I want to fight somebody, because to even have the audacity to ask that, you don't rate to know what I've been through. You don't deserve to know. You're some quack who I've never met and I don't know anything about. No, I'm not going to tell you my deepest, darkest moment where my best friend was injured or killed in front of me. No, I'm not going to tell you that. You don't deserve it. And to even explain that to somebody is like explaining – imagine trying to explain the taste of apple pie to someone who's never eaten it. That is explaining combat to someone who hasn't been there. So to say in 1 minute that you're comfortable talking to somebody is like – again, it's like being naked in front of them and you don't know them and you don't know why they're asking. Why do you want to know? Why do you want to do this? You know, and so that's one of the major faults in our system. But again, I'll turn it back over before I go a little ramp crazy here and I start cussing on this thing. I think I've already dropped one curse word, so I have to stop myself.
Well, Joe said it better than I, but these are things we who don't have PTS need to constantly be remembering. They're coming from a different world. They've been forced to inhabit, and it's a much less easy world than the rest of us get to float through daily. In line with the forced intimacy of psychological exams, any kind of confined space, any place where the person feels like their escape options are limited. So whether crowded or not, a lot of times kind of a claustrophobic reaction is very common. And similar to that, driving, especially out here in California, in the Bay Area, in the Sacramento area, where there's so much heavy traffic, where congestion, road work often will imprison the combat stress sufferer in just a huge sea of vehicles all around. That can create tremendous stress. Road rage is, in many ways, a natural and unavoidable reaction to overwhelming anxiety on the highways of freeways of urban driving, especially if it's an unfamiliar place or if something unusual should appear, a person on an overpass, a pile of garbage at the roadside, things that the non-traumatized person will whiz past and not even take note of will become the focal point for all the combat vet's attention. So that experience, both the anxiety and the anger that arise during driving, will cause so many vets to avoid driving, especially during peak hours. It's not uncommon for our vets to be brought to therapy by a spouse or request an appointment during a time of day when they don't have to deal with too many folks on the road. Another thing that is routinely avoided, Joe and I were talking about earlier, is watching the news. As we all know, the news is full of sensationalized, morbid stuff, and veterans already have horrible memories kicking around in their heads. Particularly political developments of late with terrorism, ISIS, the sort of immediate automatic ceding of territory that was won with blood and tremendous loss, just sort of handing it back over. The political and social ramifications of the current terrorism problem here and overseas kind of dominates the news, but it's something that for the rest of us may be dispiriting or upsetting, but for vets is intolerable. And so it's pretty common. Most therapists that I know will advise veterans to avoid watching the news, or at least limiting it sharply. And so that's another example of some avoidance being maybe advisable. What I find with my vets, though, is a lot of times they can't help but watch the news. It's part of the hypervigilance. So you may get extreme avoidance or kind of constant immersion as a way of standing guard, so to speak. Movies also, war movies can go either way. Some veterans are very almost obsessively interested in combat movies, but a huge chunk will avoid them like the plague, in part because sometimes Hollywood depicts things in a way that's so far off that it's really disrespectful to what really happened.
I sure wish I had a Hollywood magazine when I was over there. Never goes dry, just shoots all the time. Hollywood grenade can blow up a whole building. Man, I don't know where they get their guns, but I need to shop at that store.
Yeah. So all kinds of cultural things like news and movies, newspapers, various media become just absolutely intolerable triggers. Now, getting emotionally close to other people, this is a real, real sticky one because veterans are not apathetic or callous people by nature. They're actually, most of the veterans I know, deep down, if you get them to talk about their moral compass, their value system, they are idealists. Almost to the point of being romantic. And that, in conjunction with the shattering experiences of war, leaves a person numb, feeling hollow, feeling frozen. In other words, there's a lot of love in veterans' hearts, but trauma buries it under so much rubble that it can be awfully hard to detect sometimes. In fact, I'm going to talk about this in a minute, the ways veterans express their compassion and their love can come across as kind of the opposite to people who don't really understand what's going on. But in essence, what I think is the avoidance heart of the whole thing is veterans have learned – well, let me back up. I have learned from working with veterans that war conditions, life or death conditions of battle, can create bonds that are like none other, that are virtually impossible to replicate outside of the combat zone, and that are virtually impossible to find again once one has left the combat zone. And given the incomparable intensity of a battle buddy love, when that kind of love is demolished and destroyed by the death of somebody close, it makes love or any feeling of emotional closeness feel like the most dangerous condition imaginable. So no matter how much veterans love their families, their spouses, some of their close friends, brothers and sisters, almost always the expression of that love becomes compromised or changed in some difficult way by trauma. And certainly getting close to new people is almost always a no-go. So many guys have told me after my best friend or so-and-so got killed, I didn't even want to know the names of new people. Now, this can be particularly tough for somebody who is in a position of leadership. So especially if somebody was killed or wounded for whom one felt responsible, then post-war, the relationship of that veteran to people they feel responsible for, like their wives and children, can become almost like that of a drill sergeant, so that love is expressed with a fierce kind of commanding impatience that is often hard to detect as a loving stance. And then finally, what is most avoided, above all, is thinking or talking about the traumatic event. As Joe said earlier, a lot of the reason for that is that the potential audience for those expressions, those narratives, hasn't earned the right to hear it. You know, who's worthy of hearing that except the people who you've been through it with? And the people who've been through it with already know about it. So it almost becomes a situation where there's nobody that the veteran can think of that really needs or should be hearing about this. And then you combine that with the fact that thinking or talking about the event typically brings up overwhelming emotions, and you get the internal avoidance combined with the external avoidance. And so what you end up with is what one of my veterans told me one time in succinctly describing post-traumatic stress. He said, war creates its own private hell for everybody. And so getting close to other people and getting close to one's own memories and feelings feel impossible. And the numbing and avoidance patterns that we've been talking about take over. Underneath all the other avoidance that is visible on the outside, I believe, is a profound avoidance of one's own experiences, memories, and feelings. So when emotional numbing and behavioral avoidance that we've been talking about, when they aren't enough to manage the anxiety, persons suffering from post-traumatic stress often turn to substance abuse. It's widely known. And the main numbing agents that are used the main numbing agent that's used far and away is alcohol. Every time they do a comorbidity or correlation study, they find a higher number than before about the percent of folks with post-traumatic stress who abuse alcohol. The latest studies I've seen are somewhere between 80 and 90%. Person with a PTSD diagnosis, 80 to 90% chance that at some point in their lifetime they'll meet criteria for a diagnosis of alcohol abuse, if not dependence. Other chemicals that numb, numb emotion include opioids. That could be street drugs like heroin or commonly prescribed pain pills like hydrocodone, oxycodone, Percocet or Vicodin, occasionally morphine or methadone. A couple of my clients are prescribed buprenorphine, which is a newer medication to deal with chronic opiate addiction. And that one is supposed to be less likely to give you a high, but these couple guys that take it say that also numbs them out. So there's a whole lot of things that you may be prescribed by a doctor that will do this. The benzodiazepine family, that's the Valium family of anti-anxiety drugs, widely used with post-traumatic stress. That'd be Valium, Klonopin, Ativan, Xanax. And the studies show that if it's prescribed sort of as a fire extinguisher, something you just sort of take, keep in your pocket and take if a panic attack looks like it's about to strike, that's not such a big deal. But when it's prescribed on a scheduled basis, like four times a day, that's kind of like drinking at a low level all day long. And it really keeps you too numbed out to benefit from post-traumatic stress treatment. So if you are prescribed those medications and you undertake a PTS therapy program, you probably need to talk to your doctor to make sure that you're not too numbed out by the meds to benefit. Marijuana here in California, of course, a lot of folks do use marijuana in some form or fashion, and it's not the jury's kind of still out on how that affects a person long term. But what I usually ask my guys is if you do smoke, at least don't do it before you come to class or group because you're probably going to be a little too hazed out to be feeling what you need to feel to move forward in this process. So the problem with all substances, regardless of its particular chemical nature, the problem is if a person relies on it too much, over time their main relationship in life comes to be with that substance, and human relationships start to take a back seat. And we've all probably seen that personally, how that works, or known somebody who's fallen into that trap. So substances can really sort of insidiously be incorporated into all the other avoidant mechanisms. A lot of folks with PTSD specifically drink at night to try to relax and sleep. And alcohol numbs the person emotionally, but it also blocks deep dreaming, blocks REM sleep. So It has the wonderful short-term side effect of suppressing nightmares. Problem is you basically just sort of pass out, wake up in a few hours, and can't get back to sleep. So, you know, alcohol is a great short-term solution and almost universally used short-term solution to PTSD symptoms at night. It's a crappy long-term solution because it actually causes anxiety and depression to intensify in the long term. And then one other thing that we might not think of as a numbing agent, because it's not a chemical, it's a behavior, and is actually rewarded mainly in society, and that is what we call workaholism. We are seeing a sort of a second wave of Vietnam vets in recent years who have become either unable to continue working at the extreme levels that they did, forced to retire, or some medical issues come along and they've had to cut back. And so, I have very successful veterans, Vietnam vets in particular, who threw themselves into work and did extremely well materially, and only now that they finally had to kind of step back from their 80 to 90 hour work week, only now are they realizing some of the costs of that workaholism in terms of family relationships and developing their own recreational interests and other sorts of things that don't have to do with work. But they're also finding they don't have anything to lay their hands on. You know, they can't stand downtime, and keeping busy becomes an almost a frantic pursuit, so that the post-traumatic stress memories don't catch up. So those are all things that fall, I think, under the umbrella of numbing and avoidance. So I want to talk a little bit about the reasons behind it. And then I want to talk to Joe a little bit about some of the interactions that he's noticed in his relationship with his own family, because I think they're really representative of how numbing and avoidance can unintentionally invade the expression of love for the people that we're closest to. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the biology of numbing. We talked about this a little in the first podcast, that there is a kind of a disconnect that's set up between the emotional processing parts of the brain and the frontal lobes, which are the cortex of the brain, not just frontal, but variety of areas of the brain in the outer part, the cortex, where our higher order functioning resides. That would be things like logic, choice making, inhibition of responding. And so, as I mentioned last time, the interior, the emotional sort of animal part of the brain, which governs fight or flight, is often being triggered, is often sending out rage and fear reactions. And so the person is often flooded with fight or flight based emotions. And it seems like sometimes the frontal lobe has just sort of had enough and hits the circuit breaker and shuts that down. So as I mentioned last time, Judith Herman calls it the dialectic of trauma, the sort of endless interplay of opposites. A person's either flooded or numb. So we don't know exactly the mechanism of this, but sometimes it does appear that the brain says enough's enough, I'm not going to feel anything, and just kind of wrenches off the main emotional valve. Now there's another interesting biological finding that might contribute to this, and that is that during the traumatic events themselves, a certain dissociation takes place. People describe it as watching it in slow motion, watching it happen as if it was from a position outside myself. And this emotional detachment appears to have something to do with increased production of natural opiates in the brain, endorphins, enkephalins, dynorphins. There's these chemicals that are sort of natural painkillers involved in things like the quote-unquote runner's high when a person exerts themselves to extreme physical levels. And it appears that when a person's under extreme emotional duress, the brain also releases these things. The problem is the brain dials down the sensitivity of the receptors in the brain for the pleasure-producing opiates, which involve dopamine. So basically your brain's flooded with numbing chemicals, but the pleasure receptor that makes a person, say, get high from opiate medications, that's basically turned off. So what you have is the numbing effect without the pleasure. So it's not like persons with PTS walk around in a blissful stupor. The numbing is not a pleasant feeling. It's unpleasant, but it's kind of muted or dulled. So these are things, and I'm sure we're going to find more over time. There's so much goes on in the brain in the wake of trauma. But just like any other symptom, numbing and avoidant symptoms are underpinned by biological changes. Take-home message being, you don't choose this. It's not your fault that you are numb. But you know, on a personal ethical level, that doesn't absolve you. If you love your family, if you care about finding purpose and meaning, if you want to honor the people you've lost, the fact that this isn't your fault and that it happened automatically, it doesn't absolve you, in my mind, of the responsibility of doing something about it. But I think when the guilt is there on the front end of what the hell's the matter with me, I shouldn't be this way, why am I such an ice man, it is important to remember this happens to anybody who's traumatized and you can't do a thing about it at the time.
My argument to that, my argument to people who act like they shouldn't have to deal with this is, well, when you fall and break your arm, you don't complain that you have to go to the doctor. And it's not your fault always. Oh, sometimes you just trip and you fall and you break your arm and you have to go to the doctor. Well, hey, you tripped, you fell, you landed in combat. Now you need to go to the doctor. I mean, I hate that excuse of, well, I shouldn't have to deal with this. Well, you do have to deal with it. It doesn't damn well matter why you have it. It doesn't matter that a lot of diseases that children have, they shouldn't have. You still have to go to the doctor. It is what it is. Get over it. So continue. Sorry. I get mad at that weak-ass excuse. I hate weak-ass excuses. This is not going to be a show where you get to hear a bunch of soft people talking about how nice this is. This is a horrible thing, and it sucks. But you know the only way to deal with horrible things is to headbutt them until they die, to go deal with it and go to the doctor and deal with it. And that's what it is. So continue. Sorry.
Thank you, Joe, for that bit of tough love.
I just don't – like I said, I hate weak excuses. You were a tough dude. You went to combat. You sucked it up. Well, now you have to suck it up again, and that's not fun, and it's not pleasant, but it is what it is. And you can either deal with it or you can die alone in a cave somewhere because you're pissed off and you're being a jerk and you've gone through five wives and your kids hate you. Those are your choices. Make that choice today. Make the choice today to go to the vet center and deal with it, not to whine at home about how tough it is. It sucks. Too bad. So, again, I'm going to stop. I'm going to be motivated now. Go.
Well, Joe, you actually transitioned me to the next thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah, you've got to suck it up in a different way in dealing with this. And I think, as I said last time, it is important to look at what a almost completely 180-degree turn dealing with this stuff is. I mean, if you think about Vietnam, the common refrain out there was don't mean nothing. And suck it up and drive on is kind of the current echo of that. What these phrases are code for really is we are in a situation where you can't afford to bitch, whine, complain, ruminate about what's so painful right now. We've got a job to do and we've got to push forward. Well, the complete switch now is you still got a job to do and push forward, but this time you've got to stop and deal with the emotions in order to push forward effectively because the mission now is different. Emotional numbing is a survival skill that develops in trauma situations, and trauma situations occur in circumstances where the danger is still present, and it's going to be present for a while. So emotional pain and its processing get blocked automatically because you've got weeks and probably months left where you can't afford to come apart at the seams. We call this deep learning, any kind of reaction learned under life and death conditions is burned into the brain. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the more specific elements of that deep learning. I believe that what really is happening in terms of emotions is a conversion of soft emotions into hard emotions. And there are probably many more than the three I've contemplated, but I think the big three are grief, which is a soft emotion that has to be converted into its harder version, and that typically becomes numbing, anger, and or guilt. So sorrow, really feeling the depth of sorrow, usually gets crammed into a hard emotion that sort of explains the loss. I'm pissed off because we didn't get adequate support. These ROEs are destroying our ability to fight properly. this loss occurred because I screwed up, so therefore I hate myself, or just feeling nothing, you know. I'm just going to push on and not even think about this. So grief gets transformed into something harder and more survival promoting. Fear, same thing. Research is crystal clear that performance tends to improve with a little bit of anxiety. If you're afraid you're going to flunk the final and you study your butt off, it's actually that anxiety ended up being a motivator and it helps. But overwhelming fear makes a person incapacitated. And so it has to be converted into something more useful. And in the combat zone, that becomes anxiety and hypervigilance, always being on alert. The fear is sort of held at a mid-level where performance is likely to be at a peak and you're sharp. And the fear, the deeper fear about death, about things being uncontrollable, that kind of gets put on the shelf. And then to come back to what we talked about before, I think the most dangerous soft emotion out there is love. And again, when it's been combined with excruciating loss in the form of combat trauma, love has to be converted into something less compromising. So it gets turned into fierce loyalty to a few people and tremendous protectiveness. I talked about this again last time. When I teach the class, I'll ask guys, how many would give their life instantly for their family? And everyone's hand goes up. And how many of you who would give your life for your family also yell at them, bark at them, get pissed off at them, and have trouble expressing love for them in terms of soft ways, hugging, saying I love you, and so forth? Often love gets expressed in fairly harsh ways. Joe and I talked about it during a break a minute ago. I'm going to ask him to speak a little bit about the drill sergeant phenomenon.
All right. I consider it a drill instructor, but at the same time, I really consider it like a combat instructor. We'll go to a restaurant, and I sit in a certain spot, and my wife's used to that. But sometimes I'll look over, and she's sitting in the walkway, and I think, good God, how do you not know that that's the most dangerous place here? Like, are you dumb? Do you not get that if somebody comes in to rob this place, if something happens, A, you're in between me and them and I can't physically draw down on them without aiming at you. B, if it does happen, you're in their way and they might physically or, however abuse. And the conversation that we'll have usually goes, well, but that'll never happen. And in my mind, I say, but it has happened and it will happen. It happens every day in America. Why is this restaurant not the place? How do you not think that this is the place? And it's not just her. It's everybody I sit with. It's every person. And you have to temper yourself because it's love. I say it like this. I love differently than I used to love in a way that normal people – that I say normal. I hate that word. But that other people, non-PTSD vets, would consider love is a real stretch for us. It's a real stretch for me anyway. I say us as if I know all of you. But I mean it's a stretch because – I don't want to hug you. I don't want to kiss you. I mean, my children are one thing, but a one-year-old is easy to love. But it's hard to want to show your emotions to people like that because I want you safe. I have no time for the BS nonsense of hugging. I'm watching my safety and security cameras around my house. I'm cleaning my firearms so that if somebody kicks in the door, I can deal with them. I'm doing things that are, in my mind, much more important, but in normal people's minds and in non-PTSD vets' minds, they think you're just a jerk and you go, no, I'm protecting my herd. I'm protecting my people. These are my people and I'm their sheepdog. And I'll be damned if anybody hurts them. And if they needed a kidney, I'd give them a kidney. But I have a hard time giving them a hug. And I know it's weird for those of you listening who are not PTSD combat vets, for the wives, for the children, for the mothers and grandmothers out there who want to hear this program, it's not that we don't love you. It's that we want you safe more than we want you. We just don't want you dead. We don't want you to die. And so we're going to do everything in our power to not allow you to get injured. And it doesn't seem like love to you, but believe me, to us, it's the highest form of love that there is. It's I'm protecting you in a way that I couldn't protect so-and-so back on the field. And I don't want to use names on here because I have a lot of them that I could throw out. And I'm about to start crying right now, so I'm going to stop. But I love you so much that I don't want you to die. I love you so much that I need you around. And again, it doesn't seem loving, but to us it is. I mean, it's the most important kind of love is I'm throwing my body in front of the bullets for you. I'm sitting in a way to where I can protect you. And for you to ignore that and not – and to sit somewhere stupid like that, not only – I see it as stupidity. I see it as lack of caring, and it makes me want to physically move you. It makes me say, holy shit, do you not even know that that's a danger zone that you're in? How do you not see that, or do you just not care? It's – we used to always say stay alert, stay alive, and complacency kills. Well, you're being complacent. So the sergeant in me wants to snatch you up. And so when you turn to me and you say, what do you want for dinner? And I say nothing, or I growl, or I frickin' look mad, it's because I am mad. And you don't get why. And none of you will, because you just see me as a jerk who couldn't order his food. And I'm not a jerk who couldn't order my food. I'm a guy who sees you sitting in a danger zone and wants you to move before you get hurt. And that's why I can't order a hamburger right now and eat it, because I'm so pissed off that you don't care that you're being complacent. And where you see me being non-loving, I see you being complacent. And I don't want you to die. So that's – I'm going to wrap it up, because I could go again on and on. I talk a lot. So
if you listen to this thing more than once, listen to that part again. That's really the heart of what we're talking about today, and much better said than I ever could. Thank you. Along with difficulty showing love to the living, a lot of veterans have trouble expressing sorrow and mourning the dead. This is not a main issue, but a significant secondary issue I run into a lot. Veterans expressing guilt and sometimes mystification at their own inability to go to funerals, or own inability to show emotion at the funerals of people they certainly loved. Why couldn't I cry at my mom's funeral? Why couldn't I cry at my buddy's funeral? I couldn't bring myself to go to that ceremony honoring these three guys that were killed, so on and so forth. Either not going physically and avoiding the situation, or not being able to experience any emotion during it.
Generally, we run into being task-oriented instead of emotionally driven. So when you see us at a funeral and we're trying to get somebody else chips or a drink, it's because I'm deep in my emotional avoidance.
Yeah.
I'm helping grandma to her seat because I don't want to think about what I'm going through. I'm helping my dad find something. I'm helping people walk around, and I'm parking all their cars for them, not because I want to help, but because if I have a task, I don't have to feel. And so absolutely, I just had to interject that, because that's how I always deal with it, and I know a lot of guys who do the same thing.
Absolutely. And a classic is I couldn't shed a tear at so-and-so's funeral, and I feel like a robotic asshole. But then I come home and I cry over stupid shit on TV. I cry at a McDonald's commercial. I cry at the Budweiser commercial with the little Clydesdale Colt. Why is this, Doc? Why could I not shed a single tear for somebody I love deeply, and then I cry at this stupid trivial crap on TV? Again, totally mystified. And so what I ask them to reflect on is, you know, what's happening here exactly? Where does that grief go? Where does that sorrow go? If it can't come up at ground zero, at a place where it's just too emotionally loaded, there's too much fear of falling apart, the pain is too great, what happens to that sorrow? Well, it's kind of like water underground. It has to leak sideways. It leaches out until it reaches a far enough away position that it's safe to come up. And that's the stupid crap. That's the trivial stuff that becomes sort of the surrogate place of shedding of a tear or two for what's really hurting a person. But that deep reservoir of grief remains until we systematically start to approach it in our trauma processing. The cycle of being flooded and numb continues. And remember, as we talked about before, one of the hallmark features of post-traumatic stress is this overarching, maybe vague, but never ceasing feeling that the other shoe is going to drop. Trauma teaches a person that tragedy, catastrophe can strike absolutely unpredictably. So it's always a threat that hangs over a person's head as they go through all these struggles that we're talking about to deal with emotions and love and negotiating some sort of truce with society and all these other things. Hanging over their head are specific fears. One would be of sleep. Many vets dread sleep. As I said before, many of us who have had a rough day look forward to going to bed that night. It's kind of a respite. For vets, the struggle is just beginning sometimes when they go to bed because of those technicolor nightmares that are just so horrifying. There's the same kind of fear of a flashback or being triggered. Almost always that is associated with having to interact with other people who don't understand the person. Over time, you know, as the sufferer with post-traumatic stress goes on with their life, it's constantly reinforced that the world doesn't get it, that the people they deal with don't know what they know, that they're having to basically speak a foreign language now. For instance, as Joe described before, trying to explain why I give the knife hand and bark orders, I'm trying to keep you alive. And so this sense of disconnection and having to talk across a vast gulf or void really takes its toll on a person. And human interaction becomes something the person, if they don't dread, they certainly feel a sense of anxiety about it. And then ultimately the deep down fear, I think, is that one's own emotions, if they're ever released, whether it be rage, whether it be fear, whether it be sorrow, is going to cause something catastrophic, cataclysmic. They're going to kill somebody. They're going to be so overwhelmed by their own pain that they won't be able to handle it. They'll become suicidal, or they'll become crazy. They'll no longer be functional. If you hear nothing else that I say today, hear this, though. It's not the facing of one's pain that leads one into suicidal depression. I'm certainly absolutely convinced that all the tragic suicides that are happening today among combat vets are occurring in situations where the person is fundamentally isolated, whether they are trapped in a relationship with alcohol or drugs, or in a situation where they don't have anybody around them that they feel safe to talk to. It's the stuffing, it's the running from it that finally gets the person in the end. It's not facing them, not facing the issues in a supportive environment that's going to cause the ultimate collapse. Okay. Avoidance, though, is tremendously, tremendously relieving in the short term. And so anything, this is just human nature, anything that we find that provides relief becomes ingrained and we're more likely to do it. It's called negative reinforcement, and that doesn't mean punishment. It means removing a painful stimulus in such a way that it's rewarding and reinforcing. So anytime you avoid that uncomfortable family gathering, anytime you drink a few beers before you go to bed, you know, you're teaching yourself that you need those avoidance maneuvers to get along in life. So it becomes deeply ingrained, it becomes second nature, and it reinforces those biological changes that predispose a person to numbing. Okay, which I guess brings us to the final part of this, which is looking at the costs and then how to try to mitigate or prevent the costs of chronic numbing and avoidance. Okay, so let's take them one at a time. These are just ones that I've thought of and that I've observed. I'm sure there are many more costs of chronic numbing. But first of all, think about, and again, this is for those of us who don't suffer from post-traumatic stress, think about watching a horror movie. You're waiting for the madman or the monster to jump out, constantly waiting. And so avoidance is like it's always expecting and avoiding and awaiting the sudden appearance of that madman, of that monster. And as we wait and watch that movie, our fears just continue to ramp up and ramp up and ramp up until suddenly the horrible thing pops out. Now think about it in a Halloween movie or a Friday the 13th or whatever. Once you see that horrible villain, he's hideous, he's ugly, but when you're staring steadily at him, you can handle him. It's what you don't see, it's what you're waiting to pop out that really eats you alive. Okay, so chronic numbing and avoidance is like that. The fears just grow and grow, whatever the it is in your life that you're avoiding, showing love more openly, facing your pain, processing your trauma, dealing with the world, going to that Kings game. The more we think about it as something we can't do, the more we teach ourselves that it's the truth. Okay.
I will tell you this, your movie analogy, and the one major difference is we don't have that creepy music to let us know it's about to happen. We think it's going to happen at any second, all day, every day. I mean, watch a horror movie, watch your next horror movie with the sound off, and try not to anticipate the guy jumping out at you. Try not to anticipate Jaws biting somebody's leg off. And that's the truth. I mean, you don't hear it coming. You don't know it's coming, and you know it could come at any second. And when it does come, are you going to be ready to handle it? Are you going to save your wife's life? Are you going to be able to do whatever's next? And that is why we – that's why a lot of us become like preppers almost, where we – where we get the firearms and the ammo and the food ready and the – because we're trying to come up with every scenario where that boogeyman, where that bad thing could happen, and how can we stop it all? And what drives us crazy and what – one of the millions of reasons why we don't sleep is always trying to come up with the next reason, the next boogeyman. What's the next thing? If there's an earthquake, if there's a fire, if there's a gunfight, if there's a – the guy next door goes crazy and kills his wife, if this, if that, if this, if that. And you're always, always, always thinking of the next thing that could happen. And you're never, ever satisfied that you're ready for it. I damn near bought a missile silo to move my family into. And people laugh at that and they think, oh, that's crazy. You're crazy. Yeah, I am, I guess. But I wanted them safe. So I buy, you know, if I'd have been a millionaire, I'd own the damn thing. Believe you me. If I had the money, we would have an apartment in an effing missile silo because – I know that you can't get through the concrete with anything short of a direct hit with a nuclear weapon. And it's silly. And I know it's silly in the daylight. But in the darkness, when the demons come, it made logical sense to me. And that's one of the other things is logically in the daytime you can say certain things. But in the darkness when you're alone at night and the demons come, you think, that makes a lot more sense than it did in the daylight. And so you think these random things. And all right, again, I'll pass it back off. But I go on these tangents because I think I want you guys to hear that it's not just you who has these weird thoughts. At least I don't think it is.
Not at all. These aren't tangents, Joe. They're great illustrations of the abstract stuff I'm talking about.
I had one more thing to add actually.
Go ahead.
And it was in your last segment, but I just wanted to add it now. There's a great TED Talk. You were talking about isolation. And I wanted you to watch this. If you guys ever watch TED Talks, go and look. I think the guy – it's Johann Hari, I think, maybe Harry. It's H-A-R-I. And it's about addiction, but it works just as well with PTSD. The concept of the talk is about isolation. And it's called Everything You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. And I really, if you have someone in your life who has PTSD, watch this. And I guarantee the same concepts will be true of whether they are addicts or whether they are alcohol abusers or whether it's just the PTSD you're dealing with. I guarantee that talk will help you understand them better. So – Johann Hari, Everything You Think About Addiction or Everything You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. Sorry. Continue.
Thanks, Joe. So as the avoidance becomes addictive, sort of like a substance takes over your life, as it provides relief and you want to do it again and again and preemptively before triggers can even strike, it becomes automatic. It takes over your life. And so I think this is one of the main ironies of post-traumatic stress, that in trying to pursue a feeling of being in control, you actually lose control of your choices. Your world starts to shrink. And over time, the capacity to differentiate truly dangerous situations from non-dangerous situations, it kind of decreases. More and more things start to get painted with that broad brush or as unsafe. And so keep coming back to Joe's example, going to a Kings game feels like a tremendous risk, which he had to teach himself was not as dangerous as he thought. He had to teach himself behaviorally. He couldn't argue himself into it. He had to go because, you know, you acquire post-traumatic stress through experience, so it follows that you have to teach yourself to live with it through experience. You can't just sit and think your way out of it.
Believe me, I tried.
Oh, I'm sure you did. And so, you know, there's something called stimulus generalization, which causes your world to shrink. And that's where we associate one situation, like a dangerous crowded marketplace in Iraq with a suicide bomber. We associate that with any crowded situation with a potentially aggressive person. And so, you know, as we make those links, we start to bring in more and more situations that we feel we must avoid.
I'll give you one more example of that that I couldn't overcome, and that's the Giants won the World Series, and they've done it three times now. And all three times I wanted to go to the parade so bad I could taste it. And I would get ready for it that day, and I might even get dressed and try to go. I might try. And then I couldn't go. Just couldn't. Just physically couldn't. Wanted to. I've wanted the Giants to win a World Series since I was 5 years old. I've thought it would be the coolest thing in the world to see them come down the street with that championship trophy. And there was no damned way I was going to that thing. I wanted to. Like I said, I wanted to really bad. In fact, another example, two gentlemen stopped everyone in the country probably knows about this, but the two guys from Sacramento who stopped that train shooting in France, they had a parade here. And I actually got in the car. I got dressed, got in the car, drove down there, parked in the parking garage, and cried for an hour while it was going on because I couldn't get out of my car and go. I could not be in a crowd of people. And it sounds silly to people who don't have this condition. They think, oh, well, why did you get dressed? Because I was trying to go. I put everything into it. And as soon as I stopped that car, I knew there was no chance I was opening that door. And I sat there and I tried to get out probably 100 times. And I started weeping because I couldn't. I physically couldn't get out of that car. And it's believe me, the worst judger of that is yourself, because you'll sit in that car and you're crying because you're upset. And you're pissed at yourself because you're crying. Because what kind of weak little girl can't get out of this car right now just by willing himself to? So when you said you try to think your way out of it, you try it all the time. Every battle that you go through, you think, what kind of weak ass can't deal with this? And I've gone through the therapy and I still have those thoughts sometimes. And I have to squish them because it's silly. It's a silly thought to think, what kind of weak ass could break their arm? What kind of weak ass could break their finger? Well, it's like saying your bone should be stronger because you're tough mentally, and that's silly. It's silly to think that you can't break the same as anybody else.
Absolutely.
But we fight it all the time. It's one of our biggest battles is thinking you're above having a physical or mental condition, and you're not. You have it. You're here. Suck it up. Go to the doc.
Another example of the stimulus generalization that makes your world get smaller and smaller was a guy I worked with who had some property up in the foothills above Sacramento, and he knew some people in town he would hang out with once in a while, but as his avoidance continued, it got to where he really felt more comfortable just staying on his property. 5-6 acres, what do I need to leave here for? My wife will go shopping for us. And then he started, there was somebody who was shooting on the adjacent property, and the other guy, the other neighbor, he had a little bit of adversarial relationship with. So he decided it was probably safer, for both him and his neighbor if he would stay in the house more. So he's kind of avoided his grounds. He wasn't making the rounds as much and just hung out in the house. And then his teenage son started to be a pain in his butt, so he really decided it would be best if he got a flat-screen TV in his room, and he started to stay in his room all the time, which he called his cave, and it got so bad that his wife would come and bring his dinner on a tray outside his room and leave it and go away. Okay. So what does that sound like? It sounds like the way a person eats when they are in solitary confinement in a prison. And that's exactly where he was. But the prison he had sentenced himself to was step by step without realizing it through the extension of his avoidance throughout all aspects of his life. The problem with this in terms of how it affects the person's overall functioning, I think what really is at the heart of it is the way it impacts self-confidence and self-esteem. Underneath the behavior, one's self-image is being steadily and inexorably squashed by the lessons that one teaches oneself through the avoidance pattern. Every time you steer clear of a situation, sort of as a reflex, every time you steer clear of it, you're sending yourself a message. And the message is basically, it's a good thing I avoided it. It was too much for me. I couldn't handle it. I had to do that. I had no choice. Okay. Over time, these messages accumulate, and they produce something called learned helplessness, which has been studied originating with rodents. If you press a button to avoid an electric shock, but then they rig the experiment to where no matter what lever you press, you get the electric shock. Eventually, the rodents get depressed. They sit. They do nothing. They just get zapped, and they do nothing to try to escape it anymore. So this learned helplessness is kind of where I think the stimulus generalization leads a person to. You've taught yourself, you got no choice. And unfortunately, learned helplessness is a major factor in depression. Depression is highly correlated with post-traumatic stress, and I think the isolation, the self-imposed isolation of the depression is a major factor that links those two conditions. Obviously, the more you avoid the world, the more you avoid social interaction. We are wired from birth to need each other. Our attachment instincts are essential to human life. And so trauma really blocks those instincts, and it cuts off the pipeline that we all need of closeness and feedback and sharing of emotions with other people. So as social isolation increases, automatically our enjoyment of life decreases, and depression, again, is often the outcome. The biggest problem of all, the biggest cost of all, of chronic avoidance, especially of one's own memories and feelings, is that they never get processed. They never get integrated into the rest of our memory system. Our memories are always accumulating. A lot of them have a very neutral emotional quality. You know, what I had for breakfast, what's my social security number, you know, how many square feet is my house? These things are memories that we store and we retrieve as needed, but they don't have a real emotional kick. It's been thought for quite a while now, and neuroimaging studies are confirming this in various ways, that traumatic memories are stored in the brain in a parallel, separate memory system from everyday memory. They're kind of shadow memory, exiled from the rest of what we are able to retrieve with a reasonable amount of comfort. And so they ambush us. It's almost like an orphaned memory that's banging on the window saying, let me in. But when it bangs on the window in the form of a flashback or a nightmare, we say, get the hell out of here. I don't want anything to do with you. And the more we flinch and turn away from remembering and feeling and sharing those experiences, the more we teach ourselves that has to be exiled. And so, again, it becomes the monster in the movie without the music that's always waiting to ambush us. And in essence, we don't have authority. I'm spared it. Persons with post-traumatic stress are not authorities over their own memory. They feel that the memory has authority over them, and they feel sort of the prey of their own mind. So there have to be conditions created to bring that sense of danger down enough that the person can safely, that feel with a reasonable degree of safety, begin to approach dealing with their own memories. As I said last time, instead of waiting for the trauma material to ambush them, they have to be provided the conditions where they can go and deal with the trauma memory and the feelings associated with it in a way that they can handle and that they don't feel is going to be overwhelming or disastrous. Okay, so what do we call this? The process of confronting internal and external avoidance. The common term is exposure therapy. Exposure, what it sounds like, facing whatever the feared stimulus is. This is the process that drains PTSD of its, PTS of its fuel supply. You know, avoidance is the fuel that the machinery of PTS has been running on, and exposure finally starts to drain it of that fuel. All effective treatments for post-traumatic stress involve some element of exposure. There are a number of sort of competing approaches out there that are touted in various studies as being superior to others, but they all have this fundamental element of exposure involved. And our program at the Vet Center is no exception. The exposure is behavioral, it's cognitive, it's emotional, and it's interpersonal. In other words, through the process of integrated treatment, we're asking you to do things that put you in more contact with the things you're afraid of, either outside of yourself or inside of yourself. Thinking about things that you prefer not to think about, dealing with emotions that you'd prefer to keep buried, and above all, breaking down those walls of isolation. So it's our contention that because the central aspect of trauma is a severing or a rupturing of bonds between people, seeing people you love killed, having to kill other human beings. Because trauma is between people, the healing ultimately and the exposure ultimately has to be interpersonal. You have to be in relationships with other folks, your therapist and fellow trauma sufferers, to heal from the trauma. This contention of ours is in line with principles of psychotherapy that have been known for a long time, that you have to have both a new experience and a new understanding before you can move forward and hold on to the gains that you've made in therapy. You can't just sit down with a self-help book and do a worksheet and have enough of an emotional experience to sort of kickstart yourself. You have to do something like speak out loud some fact, some feeling, some aspect of your traumatic experience that you have taught yourself is too horrible for other people to hear, that's too horrible for you to handle yourself. You have to speak it out loud and be surprised, have an emotional kick in the ass that this actually did not result in other people running out of the room, scoffing at you, saying, you know, you're barred from group. It did not cause you to collapse and become insane. The external and internal avoidance are simultaneously confronted in therapy when you speak out loud about traumatic events. There's a well-researched theory by Edna Foa and colleagues that in order to really gain the upper hand, to gain mastery of trauma, you need to, one, activate the fear structure. It's kind of like bringing up a computer file to edit. And two, put new and more realistic information into that computer file, into that network. For instance, replace the idea that going to the grocery store will cause you to lose it. Replace the idea that talking about the trauma will cause people to run away horrified with new and experience-based information that these experiences, while uncomfortable, can be handled. And, you know, so when this happens in group, we allow people to sit with their feelings. We don't rush in and try to argue them out of it. And then when the person has had a chance to sort of marinate in their emotional experience, then we talk about it. What just happened? How are you feeling? And those cognitive pieces, the discussion helps them cement it as a new memory that helps them hold the old memory. As we talked about before, the brain's a remarkable thing in so many ways, but one of its most powerful abilities is to make associations between old experiences and new experiences. So whenever we talk about a traumatic event in the safe context of a therapy group, we're systematically building a network of new memories in which the other people in that group are present, helping us hold our pain. And then we store the memory of those people helping us hold our pain with the memory of the original pain. So we're building a whole new nest, neurological nest, around that pain. And it helps buffer it, it helps us carry it, and it helps us whenever we retrieve that quote-unquote file of the trauma, whether we're aware of it or not, we're retrieving the memory of the people being there with us as we go through it. That's what healing really amounts to. We don't talk about cure. We don't talk about getting rid of or forgetting the stuff. You couldn't forget it if you tried. But the reality is, our vets who are thoroughly healed say they rather wouldn't forget it even if they had the opportunity to. It's part of who they are. It's shaped the new direction in their lives, and they want to honor the people involved in their trauma, however, whoever they may be, and that involves carrying it in a new way that's more manageable. So in the process of therapy, there is a great deal of exposure, particularly internal exposure, or what we call imaginal exposure, which means really just memory exposure to what happened and sharing it with the other people in group, which is the external element. What we found is that the more internal experience can be dealt with, the more external experience naturally falls in line as sort of a natural consequence. it's if you really think about it, when a person's afraid of going out in a crowd, yes, the crowd is what they're afraid of on the surface, but what they're really afraid deep down is a repetition of what they're holding in their head. Okay, so that's the underlying thing, is a repetition, the fear of the repetition of a memory which actually occurred. And so if that memory is drained of its toxins, the overwhelming fear, the rage, the sorrow, and all the other things that reside inside that memory, once that has been dealt with, the uncomfortable aspects of the world are no longer terrifying. The annoying, frustrating, angering aspects of the world are no longer as infuriating. So internal exposure automatically doesn't obliterate external avoidance, but it makes it much less prevalent, and it makes facing the outside world much more manageable. So the last thing I want to say about dealing with patterns of numbing and avoidance is what you really need to do is just have enough of an open mind that you can put yourself in contact with people that can earn your trust. Whether that be an individual therapist or ideally a well-run group. Because if you're going to rejoin the world, where else could you possibly start safely than with a few people who understand, combat veterans in particular? And the beautiful thing about the process of group therapy is that emotions are very contagious. Now, your mind won't let you be overrun with emotion, but what I mean by this is even the numbest person, if they sit long enough with some fellow vets that they respect and come to care about, who feel a little more emotion, who have a little more access to their emotion, eventually that will start to break down the walls of emotional numbing. There's some research on what's called the vagus nerve, which is the longest nerve of the cranial, the 12 cranial nerves, runs all the way from the head down through the midsection down to our gut. And the vagus nerve is lined with oxytocin receptors. Oxytocin is a bonding hormone that's released when a mother nurses a child, or father holds a child for that matter. But oxytocin is also released when two people have a trusting conversation. Two people who trust each other have a self-revealing conversation about an emotionally deep topic. It produces a feeling of warmth, of connection, and it runs all the way up and down the body. It's probably the vagus nerve is probably the source of those old terms like having a lump in my throat, heartwarming, a gut feeling. The vagus nerve is involved in human connection, and it's probably the biological factors that we need to learn more about that help people make progress on painful topics. But regardless, whether you know your vagus nerve is involved or not, and as one of my vets in group said, in other words, what you're telling me is what happens in the vagus doesn't stay in the vagus. It becomes the mechanism of contagiousness of positive emotion. And if you sit long enough with other people who get it, who are going through the same process of thawing, eventually you yourself, no matter how icy you feel, no matter how numb you feel, can't help but start to thaw yourself. So it's the process of talking about trauma in a safe environment with people you love and respect. Not only brings back some of the most important aspects of military cohesion, but it also functions as kind of a microcosm, a point of departure for rejoining society at large in ways that feel safe. And it provides a blueprint for the kind of relationships you'll be having, hopefully, for the rest of your life. Not that you'll become a social butterfly, not that you'll be out there talking to everybody about your trauma. But to go back to what we said at the beginning, not everybody needs to hear about it and not everybody deserves to hear it. In fact, I would say that very few people need or deserve to hear about what you went through. You don't need a ton of relationships in your life to be happy. You just need the ones that are in your life to be fully honored and to provide in both directions all that they're capable of, so that love can flow more freely and your self-esteem doesn't suffer as a result of the blocking of that expression. So I think that's all I have to say for today. I just want to thank Joe for giving such vivid personal examples to illustrate some of these points. Again, the take-home message being if you're dead set against therapy, while I respect and understand that
– I do not.
I'll be the good cop on this show. Joe can be the bad cop. All I would ask is that you give it a try and try to sit through a few sessions, find a therapist who you can talk to who's not going to jump the gun and probe too deeply, who will understand you're dealing with emotional numbing but won't let you get away with that altogether as a way of avoiding dealing with what you need to. Because once you've started the process, if you do start it with an open mind and you've got a decent individual and or group to go to, you can't help but make progress. The beautiful thing is you don't have to believe it's going to work. You just have to give it a chance and not close the book on it before you start. And that's how it all begins.
All right. I wanted to add this. In my group, we were all afraid of talking to each other. We were all icy cold. We were all terrified of saying anything in front of each other. And there were about 9 or 10 of us that started together and 9 of us that ended – or 8 of us that ended together. A couple guys dropped out because they either thought they'd gotten enough help or you know, whatever. Whatever the reason was, who knows. Life is a strange thing. But those of us who stuck around, those of us who went through the whole thing, by the end of it, I could have literally told them anything because it was like a deployment together where we grew trust with each other and we grew to a point where – I was telling Doc Schneider this before the thing when we were offline talking together. Some things that blew me away the most were how a guy from Vietnam fighting in a totally different war in a totally different place against totally different people, and he would say something and I thought, oh my God, I thought that last night. How are we so alike? And you realize that all combat is the same combat. All of the emotions that we feel, all of the things that we feel, you'll be amazed how connected you are to a Vietnam vet. You'll be amazed how connected you are to a Korea War vet, to a Desert Storm vet, to any other person who's ever fired a weapon in anger or had a weapon fired at them in anger. You'll be amazed how much of a brother they are. It's mind-blowing. But again, by the time we were done spending those 9 months together, I could have told them about anything, and I don't want to get too deep into it because, again, it is personal. It is my struggle. But I told them things that I wouldn't tell my wife. I told them things that I wouldn't tell my mother. I told them things that I would never tell my grandmother, you know, things that it's so deep and dark in your soul, you're afraid of what they would think of you. You're afraid that your wife would think that you're a murderer. You're afraid that your kids would think that you're some horrible monster in the night. And we were horrible monsters in the night for some people. We kicked in the doors and we snatched them out of their beds and we brought them to the facility where they were detained. And we were the horrible monsters in the night, but I don't want my kids to see that. I don't want my wife to see that. And so I wouldn't tell anybody. I would never tell anybody these things. But as life moves on, you realize I'm not a horrible monster. I was a machine. I was a cog in the wheel. I did what I was told. You know, the old Marine saying again, it does what it's told. And it did. It did what it was told. And now we're beyond that. And I got to talk to these guys and I realized, A, I'm not alone. And B, again, they're exactly like me. And they have the exact same thoughts and feelings and everything that I do. But to wrap it up today, I really want to thank Doc Schneider for coming in. For those of you who don't know, we record on Sundays right now, and we're trying to move it to a weekday so it's not his day off. But he's giving up his time with his family to help you guys. He's giving up his time with his family to get this word out, to help you guys, you know, have some version of therapy right now, even before you're willing to get off your couch and get off your ass and take yourself in somewhere. You know, I want you guys to do that because I do not accept that you have a problem with therapy. I had a problem with therapy. I thought it was hokey crap. And I still, and sometimes I still in the middle of the night, I'll say to myself, no, you're just weak. You're just weak. But you're not weak, bro. You're broken. And there's a way to fix it. And it's worthless to think that you shouldn't fix it. But again, I want to thank Doc Schneider for coming in. I want to thank him for what he said. And thank you very much.
Well, like last time, Joe, it was very much my pleasure. I appreciate the chance to come in and speak to folks that might not yet have the opportunity or the inclination to come in and talk to somebody like me in person. So hopefully this will start that ball rolling. I do want to say that, you know, when I work with people in my clinic, I can see them, I can gauge their reaction. Since I don't have that ability here, I want to make sure that for anybody who is stressed or triggered by anything that we said here today or any future podcasts, be aware there is a 24-hour crisis hotline nationwide, 1-800-273-8255. Again, 1-800-273-TALK. And I believe it's press 1 for veterans. The phone tree will tell you what button to press. But that's available 24/7. And if you feel stressed out or you're hearing this in a place where you don't have immediate access to a counselor, those folks are good and they will talk to you and set you up with follow-up. Thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate being here.
I have one more thing to add to that also. Actually, if you have anything for us, myself, Doc Schneider, any of the people you've heard on here, you can find us on Facebook at Post Combat Normal, and you can – find us on Twitter at @PTGrow. And so that's for post-traumatic growth, @PTGrow. So again, Post Combat Normal on Facebook, PTGrow on Twitter. And again, thank you all for coming. And it was definitely our pleasure talking to you. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you again next week.